acorns jumping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, furry as a mouse. It's a sweet nature, a sweet nature thing. It's a sweet nature, a sweet nature thing. It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine.
Welcome to Yarns at Yin Hu, a podcast about the fiber arts and other post-apocalyptic skills. Episode 153, Why to Blend and How. Sunday, January 29th, 2017. I'm your host, Sarah. You can find me on social media as Sarah Pomegranate. The Yarns at Yin Hu podcast has a Facebook page, and it's available on iTunes. Each week, I post photographs, show notes, and links to the things I talk about on my website, yarnsatyinhu.com. Today's episode features the following segments: ever-expanding skill set, yarn lover at large, and off the shelf. I have just completed the recording of episode 154. I know, it's a little bit backwards. It's entitled Think Pink, and it is a personal account of my participation in the Women's March in Washington, D.C. That episode doesn't have the usual segments or organization of my usual podcast episodes. And the reason I recorded it that way is so that folks who are truly interested in my story can listen to that. And folks who might just prefer the knitting and cooking content can skip that episode. It is a 20-minute episode, and it will be dropping either today or just a few days into this coming week. If you have entered the lottery for the Knit Local Getaway, you should have received communication from me over the past week. If you haven't, please let me know, and I will be sure to contact you. The interest in the getaway was a little more than the participants I can accommodate, so I do have a short waiting list for the event. Please let me know if you want to stay on that waiting list or if you just prefer to make other plans. There are several folks who said they were pretty sure they wanted to go, but plans just may not work out, and you know, there's always just the life happens sort of cancellation potential. So I have a waiting list, and those of us who are ready for the retreat are starting to get excited and chatter a little bit on the Ravelry thread. I will be providing updates and asking for additional information, making plans over there. So thank you so much for your enthusiasm. Ever-expanding skill set. It has been a busy week in the kitchen at Yin Hu. I've been doing some casserole baking, and this past week I took a chance on a casserole idea that formulated the way a lot of my meal planning formulates on my drive home. I knew I had quite a few different leftovers that I wanted to bake into a meal, and I had purchased some mushroom ravioli from the refrigerated section of the supermarket. This is quick cooking pasta. The cooking directions say that you can boil for, I think, 4 or 5 minutes. And so I was thinking as I drove home that you really wouldn't need to pre-boil that pasta. You could just put it into a casserole dish with a generous amount of sauce, because one of the principles of casserole baking is that you have more liquid than you suspect is needed so that your casserole doesn't dry out. And so I made a sauce with leftover chicken stock, leftover roasted cauliflower, a little bit of milk, a little bit of cream, some grated cheese, And then I used some diced turkey sausage that I had and topped the whole thing with a mixture of panko breadcrumbs, grated Parmesan cheese, and dried parsley. Baked for about 25 to 30 minutes until the mixture was bubbly, and it was absolutely delicious. Roasted cauliflower creates a very creamy, nutty, flavored sort of sauce. On her Digging Up the Dirt blog, Andrea Bemis had a recipe for roasted cauliflower pasta sauce. And so I was not looking at that recipe at the time, but I was sort of riffing off of that notion of using cauliflower in a pasta sauce to create something creamy and rich without a lot of dairy product in it. Also this week, I tried the recipe Ashley English has in issue 20 of Taproot magazine for almond, fig, and anise biscotti. Biscotti are a favorite recipe of mine for this time of year. They're a great twice-baked biscuit that's wonderful dunked into a hot mug of tea or coffee. And her recipe is really great. I think her proportions are good and her directions are good for baking biscotti. When you make biscotti, you create a dough and then you shape that dough into a loaf, you bake it. And then you slice it into the biscotti cookies that you're normally used to seeing, and then you bake them again. What I have often found is that slicing that initial loaf results in a lot of crumbled, broken pieces of biscotti, which is very disappointing. Especially if you want to give them as a gift or you want to have a nice presentation, I always find that they would be crumbling apart. And I think that's because I would start slicing them immediately after taking them out of the oven. But this recipe requires you to cool for 30 minutes before slicing, and I think that makes a really big difference. And so the pieces came out very crisp and beautifully shaped. And that addition of the fig with the almond and the anise is a really nice flavor. I think it's nice around the holidays, but also afterwards. I did not have anise seed, so I used 3 kinds of extract in this recipe. The vanilla and almond that were called for, and then anise extract because I didn't have anise seed. It's absolutely delicious. I'm enjoying these biscotti on a daily basis. It's a nice treat instead of a cookie, and it's a nice pick-me-up during the day with a mug of tea. As far as the Taproot make-along goes, I am also working on my journal cowl and continuing to read Icelandic folk tales. My knitting this past 2 weeks has gone backward toward that Tale of the Golden Spindle that I read to you a few episodes ago, and then forward into some of the water myths in a second or third chapter of this collection. So perhaps you remember the rather foolish man and his wife and the spindle that I designed, which looked a little bit more like a dreidel. Andy said that the mountains I had created with beautiful sunset, that they looked like candy corn. However, regardless of any shortcomings of those pieces of knitting in the cowl, I've just kept them and I've kept going. And I tried to incorporate some of the other elements of the story. So the last gift that the foolish man asks of the troll is for a ladder that will allow him to reach heaven and give his leftover porridge to the Virgin Mary. And so I used a train tracks motif that was included in the journal cowl, and I just elongated a little bit so it looked more like a ladder. that worked out very nicely. It's a very striking motif in this cowl. And then I used another motif that had kind of splotches of color on the main color background. And I used white and yellow splotches of color to refer to the splattered brains and porridge when the man and his wife got a little lightheaded on their climb into heaven and came tumbling down that ladder. So that's a nice set of motifs to reflect that one tale. It's the tale I like the most in what I've read so far. On to the water myths. There are quite a few motifs in the journal cowl pattern that refer to water, but I wanted to create one for a boat because there are a couple myths where farmers are rowing out to sea and fishermen are rowing out to sea and back. And so I created a little sailboat motif. I believe this one is much more successful than the earlier spindle, and I've included a photograph in the show notes for this episode. I'm about 30 inches complete with this cowl, and I need 54 or 56 before closing it. I think I may repeat some of my favorite motifs from the pattern, and I think I will definitely repeat that sailboat motif and maybe come up with a few more as I continue knitting the journal cowl in February. The Taproot make-along continues until March 1st. There are great photographs and conversation on the threads. There are also prizes for participation. You can see them posted on the Ravelry thread. And I love to read everyone's comments and see photographs of the things you are knitting, making, cooking, and all the enthusiasm you have for this make-along. So thank you. Yarn lover at large. Yesterday, I attended a class at the Spinnery in Frenchtown, New Jersey. This class was taught by Rebecca Diota. She and her friend Julianne Targan are the team behind Simpatico Fibers. I will link to their shop and their local appearances in the show notes. I've seen Rebecca do spinning demonstrations many, many times, but I've never been able to take a class of hers. This one was more about blending than the spinning. She's offering the spinning class in Frenchtown at the end of February. So I may or may not be enrolling in that. I'm not sure of my schedule toward the end of February. But this one on blending was incredibly informative. I attended the class with Kathy, my classmate from the Fibercraft studio, and we had a great time trying our hand at several different blending techniques. I really love Rebecca's expansive, playful approach to the process of blending. We used hand cards, blending boards, drum carders, as well as combs during the course of the class. Probably the most eye-opening new method for me was the idea of making a ghost bat. Rebecca showed us how to blend fibers with hand carders in the typical way, and that creates a woolen preparation where the fibers are very disorganized, and you roll them up to create a roll-leg. As you spin that roll-leg, a lot of air is trapped between the fibers, and that's what creates your woolen preparation. It traps a lot of air, creates a lofty and very nicely insulating sort of yarn. However, if you work as you use your hand carders to keep the fibers as aligned as possible, you can create something close to a worsted preparation. It may not be a true worsted because I'm not sure if you can really get that on hand carders, but you can get something close. And we use this technique to keep the fibers aligned as we carded and then continue to keep them aligned as we rolled them up so they were all still in the same direction. This preparation is very difficult to keep together because the fibers don't stick to themselves the same way they do when you make a roll leg. And so Rebecca taught us to begin to spin, sort of draft and spin a little bit of the fiber between our fingers, draw it out a few inches, and then wrap that single around the top of the fiber to create a little ghost. And she referred to these as ghost bats, a term I had never heard before, but it really does resemble a ghost, and it creates a worsted or semi-worsted preparation, and you can spin this very, very, very fine. I imagine doing this with some of the Shetland that I have. Of course, all of that Shetland has already been put into rolags, and I'm spinning the very last batch of them into singles right now. But maybe with a future Shetland fleece, I might try something in a very, very fine preparation. Something like a wedding ring shawl, something so fine you could pull it through a wedding ring, isn't an object I really want to have, but I feel like doing that spinning and knitting with that type of yarn is a technique I would like to try. Something more on the process side of fiber arts than the product side, and I am usually a much more product-oriented person. I was familiar with blending boards because I have one, and drum carders interest me, but I don't really see one in my future, so I always like to use them, but I'm not really invested in techniques for them because that's a big, big expense. So I don't see that happening sometime in the future. However, I do plan on purchasing hand combs at some point in the future, and I have never handled them until this past Saturday. So in the time that we had at the end of the class where we could play around with whatever tools we wanted, I went straight for the combs and just tried using them, tried them on some washed locks that Rebecca had available, and asked many, many questions about different brands of combs, different types, weights, and whether or not they were strictly for using in the hands or whether you could put them into a gadget that you can clamp to a table. And I think definitely having the versatility of being able to hold them, they're light enough to hold and use, but also being able to clamp them down is a quality or a characteristic that I want in combs I plan to purchase. I haven't made any decisions yet, but I would like to continue to experiment with them, maybe learn a little bit about them. And of course, if you own combs, I would love to hear any recommendations that you have. Off the shelf. I'd like to share a new-to-me poem with you at the end of this episode. It's by Lacante Dill, and it's titled We Who Weave. It combines some references to basket weaving as well as dyeing with indigo. And I share this poem. It's from Poetry Magazine, January 2016 issue, because many folks have expressed an interest in poetry and learning more about poetry. They enjoy poems that I share on the episode. And one of the most fascinating areas of poetry to me is ekphrasis or ekphrastic poetry. This term refers to poems that take inspiration from a work of art. There are many, many examples. The one often cited as the earliest example is Homer's description of the shield of Achilles in the Iliad. And that's notable because it doesn't refer to a real thing, but he described it with such accuracy and detail as though it were real that many people insisted that there was one or tried to search for evidence of this shield. Nowadays, there's a much more expansive relationship between poetry referring to artwork and the artwork itself because it's understood that a contemporary audience can go online and see, or turn to a book and see a photograph of this work or some kind of reproduction of it. In this case, the artwork referred to is also new to me. It's an image by Tyrone Getter, and I will include a link to it so you can take a look at this extraordinary oil painting of a woman engaged in basket weaving. We who weave. Weave me closer to you with hands dyed indigo that rake oyster beds awake. Smell you long before I see you. Vanilla sweet. Sweetgrass weaving wares that keep Yankees coming on ferries. No bridge. Water's been troubled. Makes you wonder who put the root on whom first, with doors dyed indigo. Pray the evil spirits away at the praise house. Make John hop to stave off John Deere. We migrants fighting to stay put. Even nomads come home for a low country boil, a feast for hungry prodigal sons and daughters with hearts dyed indigo, dying for you to weave us closer.
Acorns jumping off my Chinese house. Two ducks in my spyglass, furry as a mouse. It's a sweet nature, a sweet nature thing. It's a sweet nature, a sweet nature thing. It's a mighty fine,
mighty fine,
a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine,
mighty fine,
a mighty fine nature thing. Leaves lay down like a lady.
Thanks for listening. Music for this episode is So Wheat, performed by Bovine Social Club. If you enjoyed this episode, I hope that you'll consider liking the group's Facebook page, joining the Ravelry group, or leaving a star rating or a review on iTunes. Eat well and stay strong as you hone your post-apocalyptic skill set this week.
It's a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine, a mighty fine nature thing. Sycamore trees are blazing like a rainbow of fire, just like Leonard Cohen sings as a bird out on the wire. It's a sweet nature, sweet nature thing. It's a sweet nature, a sweet nature thing. It's a mighty fine,
mighty fine,
a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine,
mighty fine,
a mighty fine nature thing. Jim on going along. Six turkeys up in munching like fat hogs. It's a sweet nature, a sweet nature thing. It's a sweet nature, a sweet nature thing. It's a mighty fine, it's a mighty fine,
mighty fine,
a mighty fine nature thing. treat you how, you better tell your face to smile. Jump in a river naked and hang a country mile and say, sweet nature, sweet nature, babe. It's a mighty fine,
mighty fine,
a mighty fine nature thing. It's a mighty fine,
mighty fine,
a mighty fine nature thing.